and the walls, all in extravagant costumes. Ah, thinks I, this is the spot. And a fancy dress party in progress, too. Capital. I'll go as a chap in a green silk robe with bare feet. It's a terrible thing, drink.
Lashman Bahadur, why have you received the parana, then?
I turned, and there was Mangla walking towards me along the gallery, wearing a smile of astonishment, and very little else. Plainly it was fancy dress, and she'd come as a dancer from some select brothel, which wasn't far out, in fact. She wore a long black sash low on her hips, knotted so that it hung to her ankles before and behind, leaving her legs bare. Her fine upper works were displayed in a bodice of transparent gauze. Her hair hung in a black tail to her waist. She tinkled with bangles, and there were silver castanets on her fingers. A cheer inside, I can tell you, at any time, but even more so when you've been hanging out of windows to avoid the broker's men. "No parwana, I'm afraid," says I. "I said that's a fetching rig. Well, now, is that the door of our room down yonder?"
"Why, yes. You wish to meet their highnesses?"
She came closer, eyeing me curiously.
"Is all well with you, Bahadur? Why, you are shaking. Are you ill?"
"Not a bit of it," says I. "Took a turn in the night air. Chill it, eh?" Some drunken instinct told me to keep mum about my balcony adventure, at least until I met higher authority. She said I needed something to warm me, and a lackey serving the folk in the gallery put a beaker in my hand. What with brandy and funk, I was parched as a camel's oxter, so I drank it straight off. And another. Dry red wine with a curious effervescent tang to it. Do you know, it settled me wonderfully. A few more of these, thinks I, and they can bring the nigger in. I took another swig, and Mangla laid a hand on my arm, smiling roguishly.
"That is your third cup, Bahadur. Have a care. It is strangely potent, and the night has only begun. Rest a moment."
I didn't mind. With the liquor taking hold, I felt safe among the lights and music, with this delectable houri to hand. I slipped an arm round her waist as we looked down on the dancers. The guests, reclining in the booths around the floor, were clapping to the music and throwing silver. Others were drinking and eating and dallying. Looked a thoroughly jolly party, with most of the women as briefly attired as Mangla. One black charmer, naked to the waist, was supporting a shouting reveller as he weaved his way across the floor. There was excited laughter and shrill voices, and one or two of the booths had their curtains discreetly closed, and not a Pathan in sight.
"Their highnesses are merry," says Mangla. "One of them, at least."
A man's voice was shouting angrily below, but the music and celebration continued uninterrupted.
"Never fear. You will find a welcome. Come and join our entertainment."
"Capital," thinks I. "We'll entertain each other in one of those curtained nooks." So I let her lead me down a curved stair, giving on to an open space at one side of the floor, where there were buffets piled high with delicacies and drink. The angry man's voice greeted us as we descended, and then he was in view beside the tables. A tall, well-made fellow, handsome, in the pretty Indian way, with a curly beard and moustache, a huge jeweled turban on his head, and only baggy silk pantaloons on the rest of him. He was staggering tight, with a goblet in one hand and the other round the neck of the black beauty who'd been helping him across the floor. Before him stood Dinanath and Azizuddin, grim and furious as he railed at them, stuttering drunkenly.
"Tell them to go to the devil. Do they think the wazir is some much big
sweeper
who run to their bidding? Let them come to me, I and humbly. Khalsa scum, sons of pigs and owls, do they think they rule here?"
"They know it," snaps Azizuddin. "Persist in this folly, and they'll prove it."
"Treason!"
bawls the other, and flung the goblet at him. It missed by yards, and he'd have tumbled over if the black wench hadn't caught him. He clung tipsily to her, flicks of spittle on his beard, crying that he was the wazir, they wouldn't dare.
"And what's to stop them?" demands Azizuddin. "Your palace guard, whom the Khalsa have promised to blow from guns if you escape, try it, my prince, and you'll find your guards have become your jailers."
"Liar!" yammers the other, and then from raging and cursing he burst into tears, bleating about how well he'd paid them, half a lakh to a single general, and they'd stand by him while the British ate the Khalsa alive.
"Oh, aye, the British are marching on us even now," cries he. "Don't the fools know that?"
"They know you say so, but that it is not true,"
puts in Dinaneth sternly.
"My princess is foolish. You know you must go out to the Khalsa tomorrow to answer for Peshawar's death. If you speak them fair, all may be well."
He stepped closer, speaking low and earnest, while the fellow mowed and wept. And then damn me if he didn't lose interest and start nuzzling and fondling his black popsy. "First things first," seemed to be his motto, and he poured with such ardour that they tumbled down and sprawled in a drunken embrace at the stair foot, while Dinanath and Azizuddin stood speechless. The drunkard raised his face from between her boobies once, blubbering at Dinanath that he daren't go out to the Khalsa, they'd do him mischief, and then went back to the matter in hand, trying to climb on top of her with his great turban all awry. Mangle and I were standing only a few steps above them, and I was thinking, well, you don't often see this at Windsor. The astonishing thing was that no one else in the Durbar room was paying the least heed. While the drunkard alternately mauled his wench and whimpered and snarled at the two councillors, the dance was reaching its climax, the band piping away in fine style, the spectators applauding. I glanced at Mangla, and she shrugged.
"Raja Jawahir Singh, Wazir," says she, indicating the turbaned sportsman. "Do you wish to be presented?"
Now he was struggling to his feet again, calling for drink, and the black girl held the cup while he gulped and slobbered. Azizuddin turned on his heel in disgust, and Dinanath followed him towards one of the booths. Jawahir pushed the cup away, staggered, and clutched at a table for support, calling for them to come back. And that was when his eye fell on us. He goggled stupidly and started forward.
"Mangla!" cries he. "Mangala, you bitch! Who is that?"
"It is the English envoy, Flashman Sahib,"
says she coolly. He gaped at me, blinking, and then a crafty look came into his eyes, and he loosed a great shout of laughter, yelling that he'd been right. The British had come, as he'd said they would.
"See, Dinanath, look, Azizuddin, the British are here!"
He swung round, stumbling, weaving towards him in a sort of crazy dance, crowing with high-pitched laughter.
"A liar, am I? See, the spy is here!"
Dinanath and Azizuddin had turned in the entrance of one of the booths, and as Jawahir capered and fell down, and Mangla brought me to the foot of the staircase, I saw Dinanath white with fury, shame and loss of face before a foreigner, you see. The dancing and music had stopped. Folk were craning to look, and flunkies were running to help Jawahir, but he lashed out at them, staggering round to point unsteadily at me.
"British spy, filth! Your company bandits will come to plunder us, will they? Brigands! Will a yati?"
"Foreigner!
Vermin!"
He glared from me to Dinanath.
"Aye, ye, the British will come. They will have cause to come,"
shrieks he, pointing at me, and then they rustled him off, still yelling and laughing. Mangla clapped her hands. The music began again, and folk turned away, whispering behind their hands, just as they do at home when Uncle Percy's had one of his bad turns during evensong. I dare say I should have been embarrassed, but with a couple of quarts of mixed brandy and puggle inside me, I didn't mind one little bit. Jawa here was plainly all that rumour said of him. But I had deeper concerns. I was suddenly thirsty again, and beginning to feel so monstrous randy that if Lady Sale had happened by, she'd have had to look damn lively. Rheumatics and all. Doubtless the curious liquor Mangler had plied me with was responsible for both conditions. Very well, she could take the consequences. There she was, the luscious little teaser, by the booth, where Azizuddin and Dinanath had been a moment since. I lurched towards her, gloating, but even as I hove to beside her, a woman spoke from beyond the open curtains.
"Is this your Englishman? Let me look at him."
I turned in surprise, not only at the words, but at the slurred, appraising arrogance of the tone. Manglas stepped back and with a little gesture of presentation said,
"Flashman Sahib Kanwari."
"Kanwar is the son of a Maharaja, and Kanwari is presumably the female honorific. And that title told me I was in the presence of the notorious Maharani Jayanden, Indian Venus, modern Messalina, and uncrowned queen of the Punjab. Here and there, in my memoirs, I remarked on the attraction of the female sex, and how it's seldom a matter of beauty alone. There are breathtakers like Elspeth and Lola and Yehunala, whom you can't wait to chivy into the shrubbery, equally classic creatures, Angie Burdett Coutts, for example, or the Empress of Austria, who are as exciting as cold soup, but appeal to the baser aesthetic senses. And playing Janes, who could start a riot in a monastery. In each case, Aphrodite or the governess, the magic is different, you see. There's always some unique charm or singular attraction, and it can be hard to define. In my Jane Dan, though, it stood out a mile. She was simply the lewdest-looking strumpet I ever saw in my life. Mind you, when a young woman with the proportions of an erotic Indian statue is found reclining half-naked and three parts drunk, while a stalwart wrestler rubs her down with oil, it's easy to leap to conclusions. But you could have covered this one with sackcloth in the front row of the church choir, and they'd still have ridden her out of town on a rail. You've heard of voluptuaries whose vices are stamped on their faces. Mine, for example. But I'm over 80. She was in her 20s, and lust was in every line of her face. The once perfect beauty turned fleshy. The lovely curves of lip and nostril thickened by booze and pleasure into the painted mask of a depraved angel. Gad, she was attractive. She looked like those sensual pictures of Jezebel and Delilah, which religious artists paint with such a loving enthusiasm. Arnold could have got enough sermons out of her to last the half. Her eyes were large and wanton and slightly protruding, with a vacant, sated expression which may have been due to drink or the recent attentions of the wrestler. Bit shaky, he looked to me. But as I made my bow, they widened in what was either drunken interest or yearning lechery. The same thing, really, with her. Considering the size of her endowments, she was quite small, light coffee in colour, and fine-boned under her smooth fat. A tongue bibi, as they say, a tight lady. Like Mangla, she was decked out as a dancer, with a crimson silk loincloth and flimsy bodice, but instead of bangles, her legs and arms were sheathed in gauze, sewn with tiny gems, and her dark red hair was contained in a jewelled net. To see her then, you'd never have guessed that when she wasn't guzzling drink and men, my Jane Dan was another woman altogether. Broadfoot was wrong in thinking debauchery had dulled her wits. She was shrewd and resolute and ruthless when the need arose. She was also an accomplished actress and mimic, talents developed when she'd been the leading jester in old Ranjit's obscene private entertainments. Just now, though, she was too languid with drink to do more than struggle up on one elbow, pushing her masseur away to view me better. Slowly, up and down. It reminded me of being on the slave block in Madagascar, where no one bought me, rot them. This time, so far as one could judge from the lady's tipsy muttering as she lolled back on her cushions, fluttering a plump hand at me, the market was more buoyant.
"You were right, Mangla. He's big."
She gave a drunken chuckle, adding an indelicate remark, which I won't translate.
"Well, must make him comfortable. Have him take off his robe. Come, sit down here beside me. You, get out."
This to the wrestler, who salaamed himself off in haste.
"You too, Mangla. Draw the curtains. Want to talk with big English man."
And not about the Suchet legacy, from the way she patted the cushions and smiled at me over the rim of her glass. Well, I'd heard she was game, but this was informality with a vengeance. I was all for it, mind you, even if she was as drunk as Taffy's sow and spilling most of the drink down her front. If any ass tells you there's nothing so disgusting as a beauty in her cups, I can only say she looks a sight more interesting than a sober schoolmarm. I was wondering if I should offer to help her out of her wet things when Mangla got in before me, calling for a cloth. So I hung back, polite-like, and found myself being addressed most affably by a tall young grandee with a flashing smile, who made me a pretty little speech welcoming me to the court of Lahore and trusting that I would have a pleasant stay. His name was Lal Singh, and I still give him top marks for style. After all, he was Jandan's principal lover, and here was his mistress cussing like Sourberry Hagen and having her déshabillé mopped in the presence of a stranger whom she'd been about to drag into the woodshed. Didn't unsettle him a bit, as he congratulated me on my Afghan exploits and drew me into conversation with Tej Singh, my fat little warrior of the afternoon, who bobbed up, grinning at his elbow, to tell me how well I suited the robe he'd given me. By this time I was beginning to feel a trifle confused myself, having in short order survived an assassination plot, what a long time ago it seemed, been filled with strong waters and, I suspected, aphrodisiac, trotted up and down by a half-naked slave girl, verbally assailed in public by the wazir of the Punjab, and indecently ogled by his drunken flesh-trap of a sister. Now I was discussing, more or less coherently, the merits of the latest Congreve rockets with two knowledgeable military men, while a yard away the Queen Regent was being dried off by her attendants and protesting tipsily, and at my back a vigorous ballet was being danced by a score of young chaps in turbans and baggy trousers, with the orchestra going full steam. I was new to Lahore, of course, and not au fait with their easy-going ways. I didn't know, for example, that recently, when Lal Singh and Jawahir had quarrelled publicly, the Maharani had composed things by presenting each of them with a naked houri and telling them to restore their tempers by doing honour to her gifts then and there, which, by all accounts, they had done. I mention that in case you think my own account is at all exaggerated. "We must have a longer talk presently," says Lal Singh, taking me by the arm. "You see the deplorable condition of affairs here. It cannot continue, as I am sure Harding Sahib is aware. He and I have had some correspondence through your esteemed chief, Major Broadfoot." He flashed me another of his smiles, all beard and teeth. "They are both very practical and expert men. Tell me, you have their confidence. What price do you suppose they would consider fair for the Punjab?" Well, I was drunk, and he knew it, which is why he asked the impossible, treasonable question, in the hope that my reaction would tell him something. Even fuddled, I knew that Lal Singh was a clever, probably desperate man, and that the best answer to the unanswerable is to put a question of your own. So I said, "Why, does someone want to sell it?" At which he gave me a long smile, while little Tej held his breath. Then Lal Singh clapped me on the shoulder.
"We shall have our long talk by day," says he. "The night is for pleasure. Would you care for some opium?" "No?" "Kashmiri opium is the finest obtainable, like Kashmiri women. I would offer you one, or even two of them, but I fear my Lady Jayanthan's displeasure. You have aroused some expectation in that quarter, Mr. Flashman, as I'm sure you noticed."
His smile was as easy and open as though you were telling me she'd been bidding me to tea presently.
"May I suggest a fortifying draught?"
He beckoned a matey, and I was presented with another beaker of Mangler's finest old inspirator, which I sipped with caution.
"I see you treat it with greater respect than does that impossible sot, our wazir. Look yonder, Bahadur, and have pity on us."
For now Jawahir was to the fore again, wheeling noisily in front of Jayanthan's booth, with his black tart trying vainly to hold him upright. He was delivering a great tirade against Dinanath, and Jayanthan must have sobered somewhat under Mangla's ministrations, for she told him pretty plain, with barely a hiccup, to pull himself together and drink no more.
"Be a man,"
says she, and indicated his wench.
"With her, practice for acting like a man among men. Go on, take her to bed, make yourself brave."
"And tomorrow?" cries he, flopping down on his knees before her. He was having another of his blubbering fits, wheeling and rocking to and fro.
"Tomorrow,"
says she, with drunken deliberation,
"you'll go out to Khalsa."
"I cannot,"
squeals he.
"They'll tear me to pieces."
"You'll go, little brother, and speak to them. Make your peace with them. All will be right."
"You'll come with me,"
he pleaded. "You and the child."
"Be assured, we'll all come. Lal and Tej, Mangla here."
Her sleepy gaze travelled to me.
"Big Englishman, too. He'll tell the Malki Lat and Yangi Lat how the troops acclaimed their wazir."
"That's the Lord of War she's talking about, Goff."
"Cheered him."
She flourished her cup, spilling liquor again.
"So they'll know a man rules in Lahore."
He stared about vacantly, and his face was that of a frightened ape, all streaked with tears. I doubt if he saw me, for he leaned closer to her, whispering hoarsely,
"And then we'll march on the British, take them unawares." "As God wills,"
smiled she, and looked at me again, and for an instant she didn't seem drunk at all. She stroked his face, speaking gently as to a fractious infant.
"But first, the Khalsa. You must take them gifts, promises of pay."
But how can I pay? Where can I—"
"There is treasure in Delhi, remember,"
says she, and glanced at me a third time.
"Promise them that.
Perhaps if I gave them this—"
He fumbled in his belt and brought out a little case on a chain.
"I shall wear it tomorrow."
"Why not? But I must wear it tonight."
She snatched it from him, laughing, and held it beyond his reach.
"Nay, nay, wait. It is for the dance. Would you like that, little brother who wishes he weren't a brother?
She slipped her free hand round his neck, kissing him on the lips.
"Tomorrow is tomorrow. This is tonight, so we'll take our pleasure, eh?"
She nodded to Mangla, who clapped her hands. The music died away, the dancers skipped off the floor, and there was a general withdrawal by the guests. Jawahir flopped down beside Jandan on the cushions, leaning his head against her.
"So government is conducted," Lal Singh spoke in my ear. "Would Harding Sahib approve, think you? Until tomorrow, then, Flashman Sahib."
Tej Singh gave another of his greasy chuckles and nudged me.
"Remember the saying, below the Satluj there are brothers and sisters. Beyond it, only rivals."
He went off with Lal Singh. I didn't know what the devil he meant, nor in my growing inebriation did I care. All these gassing intruders were keeping me from the company of that splendid painted trollop, who was now wasting her talents in soothing her whining oaf of a brother yonder, cradling him against that superb bosom and pouring drink into him and herself. I was itching to be at her. And even when Mangla came to lead me to the neighbouring booth, I wasn't distracted. I guess my tastes are coarse, and I'd developed a craving for the mistress that wasn't to be satisfied by the maid, who kept the curtains open anyway, and had a matey standing by to keep me liquored through the entertainment which now began. As I said, most of the courtiers seemed to have gone, leaving the Maharani and her chosen intimates to riot with the performers. The first of these was a troop of Kashmiri girls, spanking little creatures in scanty silver armour, with bows and toy swords, who cavorted in a parody of military drill which would have scandalized the general staff and terrified their horses. This was something from Ranjit's day, Mangla told me. The girls were his female bodyguard, with whom the old lecher had been wont to battle through the night. Then there was a serious interlude by Indian wrestlers, who were the best on earth outside Cumberland, muscular young bucks who fought like greased lightning, all science and sinew. None of your crude Turkish grunting, nor the unspeakable Japanese vulgarity. Jandan, I noticed, roused from her lethargy during these bouts, rising unsteadily to her feet to applaud the falls, and summoning the victors to drink from her cup while she stroked and petted them. Meanwhile, their place was taken by female wrestlers, strapping wenches who fought naked, another of old Ranjit's fancies, with the male wrestlers and Kashmiri girls kneeling round the floor, egging them on, and then wrestling with each other, to the inevitable conclusion, while the band played appropriate music. They were all over the floor in no time, seriously impeding a troop of dancing girls and boys who had come on to frolic in a measure which proved to be a considerable advance on the polka. Now, you may not credit this, but I'm not much of a hand at orgies. I ain't what you'd call a prude, but I do hold that an Englishman's brothel is his castle, where he should behave according, as many flash tales as he likes, but none of these troop fornications that the Orientals indulge in. It's not the indecency, I mind, but the company of a lot of boozy brutes hallowing and kicking up the deuce of a row when I want to concentrate and give of my best. A regular bacchanalia is something to see, right enough, but I'm with the discriminating frog who said that one is interesting, but only a cad would make a habit of it. Still, evil associations corrupt good manners, especially when you're horny as Turvey's bull and full of love puggle. Mangle'll have to do, thinks I, if I ain't too foxed to carry her out of this bedlam. And I was just looking about for her when there was a great drunken cheer from the floor, and Jandan came swaying out of her booth, helped by a couple of her dancing boys. She pushed them away, took a couple of shaky steps, and began to writhe like a Turkish wedding dancer, flaunting her hips and rotating her plump little bottom, flirting the tails of her crimson loincloth, and giving little squeals of laughter as she turned, stamping, then clapping her hands above her head while the others took up the rhythm and the tom-toms throbbed and the cymbals clashed. That was my first glimpse of Koh-i-Noor, gleaming in her navel like a live thing as she fluttered her belly in and out. But it didn't hold my attention long, for as she danced, she screamed over her shoulder, and one of the dancing boys leaped in behind her, sliding his hands up her body, unclasping her bodice and letting it fall, fondling her as she danced back into him and slowly turned herself until they were face to face. They writhed against each other while the onlookers shrieked with delight and the music beat ever faster, and then he retreated from her slowly, sweat pouring down his body, and burn me if the stone wasn't in his navel now. How the devil they did it, I can't think. Swedish exercises, perhaps. The boy yelled and pirouetted in triumph, and jinned and staggered into the arms of one of the wrestlers, giggling while he pawed and kissed her. One of the Kashmiri bints flung herself at the boy, clasping him round the waist and wriggling against him. Damned if I could see any better this time, but she came away with the stone in turn, undulating to let the onlookers see it, and then subsiding under another youth, the pair of them heaving to wake the dead. But either he was less expert, or something else caught their interest, for the diamonds slipped out from between them and rolled across the floor, to catcalls and groans of disappointment. I was watching all this through a haze of booze and disbelief, taking another refreshing swig and thinking, wait till I get back to Belgravia and teach him the new dance step. And when I looked again, there was Jiandan struggling and laughing wildly in the arms of another dancing boy, and the great stone was back on her belly again. Hello, thinks I, someone's been handling in the scrimmage. She seized the boy's wine cup, drained it, and tossed it over her shoulder, and then began to dance towards me, the tawny hourglass body agleam as though it had been oiled, her limbs shimmering in their sheaths of gems. Now she was slapping her bare flanks to the tom-tom beat, drawing her fingers tantalizingly up her jeweled thighs and across her body, lifting the fat round breasts and laughing at me out of that painted harlot's face.
"Will you have it, Englishman? Or shall I keep it for Lal or Jawahir? Come, take it, Gora Sahib, my English Bahadur."
You mayn't credit it, but I was recalling a line by some poet or other, Elizabethan, I think, who must have witnessed a similar performance, for he wrote of her brave vibrations each way free. Couldn't have put it better myself, thinks I, as I made a heroic lurch for her and fell on all fours, but the sweet, thoughtful girl sank down before me, arms raised from her sides, making her muscles quiver from her fingertips up her arms and beyond, shuddering her bounties at me, and I seized them with a cry of thanksgiving. She squealed, either in delight or to signify foul, whipped her loincloth off and round my neck, and drew my face towards her open mouth.
"Take it, Englishman!"
she gasps, and then she had my robe open, thrusting her belly against mine and kissing me as though I were beefsteak and she'd been fasting for a week. I don't know who the considerate chap was who drew the curtains to, but suddenly we were alone, and somehow I was on my feet with her clinging to me, her legs clasped round my hips, moaning as I settled her in place and began the slow march up and down, keeping time to the tom-toms. And I fear I broke the rules, for I removed the jewel manually before it did me a mischief. I doubt if she noticed. Didn't mention it anyway. Well, I can't think when I've enjoyed a dance so much. Unless it was when we set to partners again, an hour or so later, I imagine. I seem to remember we drank considerable in between, and prosed in an incoherent way. Most of it escapes me, but I recall distinctly that she said she purposed to send little Dalip to an English public school when he was older, and I said, "Capital, look what it had done for me." But the devil was going up to Oxford, just a nest of bookworms and bestial, and how the deuce did she do that naval exercise with the diamond? So she tried to teach me, giggling through incredible contortions which culminated in her plunging and squirming astride of me as though I were running reins with only a furlong to go. And in the middle of it she screamed a summons, and two of her Kashmiri girls popped in and urged her on by whipping her with canes. Intrusive, I thought, but it was her home ground, after all. She went to sleep directly we'd passed the post, sprawled on top of me, and the Kashmiris left off lashing her and snickered to each other. I sent them packing, and having heaved her off, was composing myself to slumber likewise, when I heard them chattering beyond the curtain, and presently they peeped in again, giggling. Their mistress would wake presently, they said, and it was their duty to see that I was clean, bright, slightly oiled, and ready for service. "Walk up," says I, but they insisted, respectfully covering her with a shawl before renewing their pestering of me, telling me I must be bathed and combed and perfumed and made presentable, or there'd be the devil to pay. I saw I'd get no peace, so I lumbered up, cursing, and warning them that their mistress would be out of luck, for I was ruined beyond redemption.
"Wait until we have bathed you," giggles one of the houris. "You will make her scream for mercy."
I doubted that, but told them to lead on, and they conducted me, one holding me up on either side, for I was still well foxed. Beyond the curtains, the Durbar room was empty now, and the great chandelier was out, with only a few candles on the walls, making little pools of light in the gloom. They led me under the staircase, along a dim-lit passage, and down a short flight of stairs to a great stone and marble chamber, like a Turkish bathhouse. It was in deep shadow about its walls and high ceiling, but in the centre, surrounded by tall, slender pillars, was a tiled area with a sunken bath in which water was steaming. There was a brazier close by, and towels piled to hand, while all about stood flagons of oils and soaps and shampoos. Altogether it was as luxurious a wallow as you could wish. I asked if this was where the Maharani bathed.
"Not this Maharani," says one. "This was the bath of the Lady Chaund Kaur. Peace be upon her." "It is altogether finer than our mistresses," says the other, sidling up to me, "and is reserved for those whom she delights to honour."
She took a playful tease at me, and her companion drew off my robe, squeaking with admiration,
"Bahadur indeed! Oh, fortunate my Jane Dan!"
"She'll be fortunate to get any good out of me after a bath with you two," thinks I, admiring them boozily as they laid by their little bows and arrows and toy swords and stripped off their silver skirts and breastplates. Lovely little nymphs there were, and there was much playing and giggling as we stepped down into the bath. It was about 3 feet deep by 7 square, half filled with warm, scented water, into which I subsided drowsily, letting it lap over my exhausted frame. One of the Kashmiris cradled my head and gently sponged my face and hair, and the other went to work on my feet, and then on to my ankles and calves. "You're on the right lines," thinks I, and closed my eyes, reflecting on what a delightful time of it Harun al-Rashid must have had, and wondering if he'd ever become bored and yearned for the life of a jolly wagoner or productive farm labourer in the open air. You wouldn't catch Flashy prowling the streets of Baghdad in disguise, looking for adventure, not while there was soap and water at home. The lower wench was soaping my knees now, and I opened my eyes, contemplating the ceiling far above, all-coloured Persian designs, with a picture in the centre of a cove with a stiff neck sitting under an awning and lording it over a platoon of bearded wallahs crouched in supplication. "That's your sort," thinks I, "whoever you are, some Sikh nabob." And that reminded me of the names I'd memorized so painfully from Broadfoot's packets. Hira Singh, and Dayan Singh, and Suchet Singh, and Bagalag Singh, and Chand Kaur, and... Chand Kaur? Where had I heard that name recently? Why, only a few moments since, from the Houris. This was her bathroom. And suddenly a tiny maggot that had been wandering aimlessly through my mind snapped to attention, even as I heard swirling of water and realized that the girl had stopped soaping my knees and was swinging herself nimbly out of the bath. Chand Kaur's bath! Chand Kaur, who had been smashed to pieces while bathing! If the wench washing my hair had moved less sharply, I'd have been a goner. But when her mate jumped out, she dropped my head like a hot brick, and I went under and came out spluttering to see her in the act of heaving herself out on the tiles, and from the tail of my eye I saw the huge coloured picture in the ceiling overhead start to quiver with a dreadful scraping sound. For an instant I was frozen, sprawled in the water, and it can only have been instinct that galvanized my flaccid muscles so that I thrust myself out of the water, turning and clutching for the edge of the bath, my hand closing on the girl's ankle. That hold saved me from toppling back and gave me a purchase to hurl myself out onto the tiles, while she was catapulted back into the water, her scream of terror lost in a deafening, grinding thunder like an avalanche, followed by an almighty crash that seemed to shake the whole building and made the tiles start from their settings beneath my face. I rolled away with a yell of terror, sprawling on the wet tiles and staring back in disbelief. Where the bath had been, there was a flat expanse of rough stone filling the cavity like a huge plug flush with the surrounding tiles. From that monstrous square of rock, great rusty chains snaked up, clanking to and fro into a gaping hole in the patterned ceiling. Foam was gushing up in a curtain from the narrow fissures between the fallen slab and the sides of the bath, washing over me in a wave. And even as I stared in horror, it continued to ooze out, pink at first, and then a hideous crimson. Beyond the bath, the second Kashmiri was cowering against a pillar, her mouth wide in a scream after scream. She turned and ran, water flying from her bare body, and then stopped dead, her shrieks changing to a terrified wail. Three men were standing just clear of the shadows on that side, drawn scimitars in their hands. They wore only loose grey pajama trousers and great wide hoods, so deep that their faces were invisible. The girl shrank away from them, blubbering and covering her face. She slipped and fell on the wet tiles and tried to scramble away, while they stood like grey statues, and then one stepped forward, lightly hefting his sword. She bounded to her feet, screeching as she turned to run, but before she'd gone a step, his point was through her back. It came out like a ghastly silver needle between her breasts, and she pitched forward lifeless on the stone block. Then they were flitting towards me in dead silence, expert assassins, of whom two skirted wide to take me in flank, while the third came straight for me, his blood-smeared blade out before him. I turned to run, slipped, and came down headlong. Cowardice has its uses. I'd be long dead without it, for it's driven me to try, in blind panic, ploys which no thinking man would even attempt. A brave man would have scrambled up to run or fling himself at the nearest enemy bare-handed. Only flashy, landing arse over tip on one of the little piles of gear discarded by the Kashmiri girls, would have grabbed at her pathetic tinsel bow, snatched a dart from its quiver, fumbled it, gibbering onto the string, and let fly at the leading thug as he came leaping over the girl's corpse at me, swinging up his scimitar. It was only a fragile toy, but it was tight-strung, and that small shaft must have been as sharp as a chisel, for it sank to the flights in his midriff, and he twisted, howling, in mid-air. his scimitar clashing on the tiles before me. I grabbed it, knowing I was done for, with one of the flank men driving at me, but I managed to turn his thrust and hurl myself sideways, expecting to feel his mate's points searing into my back. There was a yell and clash of steel behind me as I landed on my shoulder and rolled over and up, slashing blindly and bawling like an idiot for help. Wasted breath, for it had arrived. The other flank man was desperately trying to parry the sweep of a Khyber knife in the hand of a tall-robed newcomer, which, with a scimitar, is rather like opposing a pea-shooter to a rival. One slash, and the scimitar blade was a shattered stump. Another, and the thug was down with a cloven skull. And the man whose thrust I'd parried leaped back and was off like a hare, dodging for the shadows. The robed apparition turned from his victim, without undue haste, took one long stride and brought over his sword arm like a fast bowler, letting the Khyber knife go. It turned once in the air and drove into the fugitive's back. He hurtled against a pillar, clinging to it with that dreadful cleaver embedded in his body, and slid slowly to the floor. 20 seconds earlier, I'd been having my knees washed. The robed man strode past me, recovered his knife, and cursed as blood splashed his coat, and only then did I realize it was a crimson garment in the tartan of the 79th. He stalked back, hunkering down to wash his blade in the water lapping over the tiles, and surveyed the shambles where the bath had been, the great rock that filled it, and the dangling chains. "Well, I'll be a son of a bitch," says he. "So that's how they did for old Lady Chowncour. No wonder we never saw the body. Guess she didn't look like much with that on top of her." He stood up and barked at me. "Well, sir, you aim to stand around bollock naked and take your death of cold? Or would you prefer to make tracks before the coroner gets here?" The words were English. The accent was pure American. Since I've seen a Welshman in a top hat leading a Zulu impi, and have myself ridden in an Apache war party in paint and breech clout, I dare say I shouldn't have been surprised to find that Gordana Khan, the complete Khyberi Hill man, could talk the lingo of Brother Jonathan. There were some damned odd fellas about in the earlies, I can tell you. But the circumstances were unusual, you'll allow, and I probably gaped for several seconds before scrambling into my robe. Then reaction seized me, and I vomited while he stood glowering like a nonconformist at the three hooded bodies and the naked white corpse of the poor little Kashmiri slut with the bloody water lapping round her. I say, poor slut. She'd done her damnedest to have me squashed flatter than a fluke. The man I'd shot was writhing about, wailing in agony. "Let him linger," growls Gordana Khan. "Mistreatment of women is something I cannot endure. Come away." He strode off to a staircase hidden in the shadows on the other side of the bathhouse, ushering me impatiently ahead of him. We ascended, and he chivied me along miles of turning passages, ignoring my incoherent questions. Then across a lofty hall, through a guard room where black-robed irregulars lounged, and at last into a spacious, comfortable room for all the world like a bachelor's den at home, with prints and trophies on the walls, bookcases, and fine leather easy chairs. I was shivering with chill and shock and bewilderment. He sat me down, threw a shawl over my legs, and poured out two stiff pegs. Malt whiskey, if you please. He laid by his Khyber knife and pulled off his puggaree. He was a Pathan, though, with that close-cropped skull, hawk face, and grizzled beard. For all he grunted, "Slaint!" as he lifted his tumbler, first clamping his neck in that strange iron collar I'd seen in the afternoon. Dear God, was it only 12 hours ago? Having drunk, he stood scowling down at me like a headmaster at an erring fag. "Now, see here, Mr. Flashman, where the devil were you this evening? We combed the palace, even looked under your bed, goddammit. Well, sir?" I made no sense of this. All I knew was that someone was trying to murder me, but plainly it wasn't this cross-grained fellow. So I'd risked horrible death hanging out of windows while he and his gang had been looking for me to protect me, by the sound of it. I removed the glass from my chattering teeth. I was out. But who on earth are you? Alexander Campbell Gardner, snaps he. Formerly artillery instructor of the Khalsa, presently guard commander to the Maharaja, and recently at your service, and think yourself lucky.
But you're an American.
That I am. He fixed me with an eye like a gimlet. From the territory of Wisconsin. I must have been a picture of idiocy, for he clapped that iron object to his neck again, gulped whiskey, and rasped, "Well, sir, you passed that word as Broadfoot instructed you should in an emergency. When, you ask? Damn it, to the little Maharaja, and again to old Ram Singh. It reached me, no matter how, and I came directly to help you. And not a hair of you in sight. Next I hear you're with the Maharani playing the devil on Jenny Golightly. Was that intelligent conduct, sir, when you knew Jawahar Singh was out to cut your throat?" He emptied his glass, clashed his iron clamp on the table, and glared. "How the deuce did you know he was after you, anyway?" This tirade had made me all adrift.
"I didn't know any such thing. Mr. Gardner, I'm at a loss."
"Colonel Gardner." "Then why the blue blazes did you sound the alarm, holler in Wisconsin to everyone you met concern it?"
"Did I? I may have said it inadvertently."
"Inadvertently? Upon my soul, Mr. Flashman."
"But I don't understand. It's all mad. Why should Jawahir want to kill me? He don't even know me. Barely met the fella, and he was tight as Dick's hat band."
An appalling thought struck me. Why, they weren't his people. They were the Maharanis. Her slave girls. They lured me to that bloody bathroom. They knew what was to happen. She must have ordered them.
"How dare you, sir?"
"So help me, it's what he said, with his whiskers crackling. To suggest that she would...
what?
After the kindness she'd shown you? A fine thing that would be. I tell you, those Kashmiris were bribed and coerced by Jawahir, and by Jawahir alone. Those were his villains down there, sent to silence the girls once you'd been disposed of. Do you think I don't know 'em? The Maharani, indeed!"
He was in a fine indignation, right enough. "I'm not saying," he went on, "that she's the sort of young woman I'd take home to meet mother. But you mind this, sir?" He rounded on me. "With all her weaknesses, of which you've taken full advantage, my Jan Dan is a charming and gracious lady, and the best hope this god-abandoned territory has seen since Ranjit Singh. You'll remember that, by thunder, if you and I are to remain friends."
I wasn't alone in my enthusiasm for the lady, it seemed, although I guessed his was of a more spiritual variety. But I was as much in the dark as ever.
"Very well, you say it was Jawahir. Why the devil should he want to murder me?"
"Because he wants a war with the British, that's why. And the surest way to start one is to have a British emissary kiboshed right here in Lahore. Why, man, Gough would be over the Sutlej with 50,000 bayonets before you could say Jack Robinson. John Company and the Khalsa would be at grips. That's what Jawahir wants, don't you see?"
I didn't, and said so. "If he wants a war, why doesn't he just order the Khalsa to march on India? They're spoiling for a fight with us, ain't they?"
"Sure they are, but not with Jawahir leading them. They've never had any use for him, so the only way he can get them to fight is if the British strike first. But damn it, you won't oblige him, however much he provokes you along the border. And Jawa here has gotten desperate. He's bankrupt, the Khalsa hates and distrusts him, and is ready to skin him alive for Peshawar's death. They hold him prisoner in his own palace. His balls are in the mangle. He took a deep breath. Don't you know anything, Mr. Flashman? Jawa here needs a war now, to keep the Khalsa occupied and save his own skin. That's why he tried to put you out with the bathwater tonight, confound it. Don't you see? Well, put that way, it made sense. Everyone seemed to want a bloody war except Harding and yours truly. But I could see why Jawa here's need was more urgent than most. I'd heard the Khalsa's opinion of him that afternoon, and seen the almighty funk he was in. That's what he'd meant, by God, when he'd pointed at me and yelled that the British would have cause to come. The evil, vicious bastard. He'd been lying in wait for my arrival. And suddenly, a dreadful, incredible suspicion rushed in on me.
My God, did Broadfoot know that Jawa here would try to kill me? Did he send me here to...
He gave a barking laugh. Hey, you have a high opinion of your betters, don't you? First my Gianta, now Major Broadfoot. No, sir, that is not his style. Why, if he had foreseen such a thing...
He broke off frowning, then shook his head.
No, Jawa here hatched his plot in the last few hours, I reckon. Your arrival must have seemed to him a heaven-sent opportunity. He'd have taken it, too, if I hadn't been on your tail from the moment you arrived in the Durbar room.
He blew out his cheeks in disbelief.
I still can't get over that damn bath. You won't linger among the soap suds again, I reckon. That was enough to bring me to my feet, reaching for his decanter without even a by your leave. God, what a tarantula's nest Broadfoot had plunged me into. I still couldn't put it straight in my mind, numb with the whirlwind of the last few hours. Had I fallen asleep over Crotchet Castle and dreamed it all? My balcony acrobatics, Mangla and Jawa here, and the dazzling spectacle of the Durbar room? The drunken, ecstatic coupling with Giandan? The horror of the descending stone, the furious bloody scramble in which five lives were snuffed out in a bare minute. This incredible tartan nemesis with his Khyber knife and Yankee twang, eyeing me bleakly as I punished his malt. Belatedly I mumbled my thanks, adding that Broadfoot was lucky to have such an agent in Lahore. He snapped my head off. I'm not his confounded agent, I'm his friend. And so far as my duty to the Maharaja allows, I'm sympathetic to British interest. Broadfoot knows I'll help, which is why he gave you my watchword. He restrained himself with difficulty. Inadvertently, by Jiminy. But that's all, Mr. Flashman. You and I will now go our separate ways. You won't address or even recognize me henceforth except as Gurdana Khan.
Henceforth? But I'll be going back. Man alive, I can't stay here now with Jawa here.
The devil you can't. It's your duty, isn't it? Just because the war isn't going to start tomorrow doesn't mean it won't happen eventually. Oh, it will, and that's when Broadfoot needs you here.
For someone who wasn't Broadfoot's man, he seemed to know a deal about my duty.
Besides, after tonight, you're in clear water. That bathhouse will tell its own story. Everyone will know Jawa here tried to rub you out, and why. But no one will breathe a word about it, including yourself.
Seeing me about to protest, he cut in.
Not a word. It would cause a scandal and might start Jawa here's war for him. So, mum, Mr. Flashman. And don't fret yourself. Now that you're under my Giandan's protection, the worst Jawa here'll dare give you is a black look.
I'd heard this kind of assurance before. Why the blazes should she protect me?
Now don't come the delicate with me, sir. He stabbed a lean finger at me. Uncle Sam with a Kandahar haircut. You know right well why, and so does every tattletale in this blasted royal bordello. Oh, sure, she has her political reasons, too. Well, just keep your mouth shut and be thankful. He nodded grimly. And now, if you're recovered, we'll return you to your quarters. And don't say Wisconsin again unless you mean it. Jemadar, Idarau. Lieutenant, come here, that means. An under-officer appeared like magic, and Gardner told him I was to have a couple of discreet shadows henceforth. He asked if anyone had been seeking me, and the Jemadar said only my orderly. Gardner frowned. Who's he? One of Broadfoot's Patans? I didn't see him arrive with you. I explained that Jassar had a habit of vanishing when most needed, and that he wasn't a Patan, or the dervish he claimed to be. A dervish? He stared. What's he look like? I described Jassar down to the vaccination mark, and he swore in astonishment, took a turn round the room. I'll be... No, it couldn't be. I haven't heard of him for years, and even he wouldn't have the hard neck. You're sure he's a Broadfoot man? And no beard, eh? Well, we'll see. Jemadar, find the orderly. Tell him the Hussar wants him double-quick, and if he asks, say I'm out at Myanmir. You sit down, Mr. Flashman. I suspect this may interest you. After the events of the night, I doubted if Lahore could hold any further surprises. But, you know, what followed was perhaps the most astonishing encounter between two men that ever I saw. And I was at Appomattox, remember? And saw Bismarck and Gully face to face with the Morleys, and held the shotgun when Hickok confronted Wesley Hardin. But what took place in Gardner's room laid over any of them. We waited in silence until the Jemadar knocked, and Jassar slid in, shifty as always. The moment his eye fell on the grim tartan figure, he started as though he'd trod on hot coals. But then he recovered and looked inquiringly to me, while Gardner viewed him almost in admiration. "Not bad, Josiah," says he. "You may have the guiltiest conscience east of Suez, but by God, you've sure got the brazenest forehead to go with it. I'd never have known you clean-shaven." His voice hardened to a bark. "Now then, what's the game? Speak up, Gildy."
"None of your goddamn business," snapped Jassar. "I'm a political agent in British service. Ask him if you don't believe me. And that puts me outside your touch, Alec Gardner. So now."
Said in Pushtu, I'd have held it a good answer. Reckless from what I'd seen of Gardner, but about what you'd expect from a Khyberi tough. But it was said in English, with an accent even more American than Gardner's own. I couldn't credit my ears. One bloody Yankee promenading about in Afghan fig was bad enough, but two? And the second one, my own orderly, courtesy of Broadfoot. If I sat open-mouthed, do you wonder? Gardner exploded. British political, my eye! Why, you crooked Quaker, you! If you're working for Broadfoot, it must mean he doesn't know who you are. And he doesn't, I'll bet... No, because you're before his time, Josiah. You skipped out of Kabul before the British arrived, and wise you were. Sikandar Burns knew you, though, for the double-dealing rascal you are. Pollock knows you, too. He ran you out of Burma, didn't he? Damn me if there's a town between Rangoon and Basra that you haven't left a shirt in. So let's have it. What's your lay this time?
I don't answer to you, says Jassar. Mr. Flashman, if you care for this, I don't. You know I'm Major Broadfoot's agent.
Hold your tongue, or I'll have it out, roars Gardner. Outside my touch, are you? We'll see. You know this man as Jassar, says he to me. Well, let me perform the honors by presenting Dr. Josiah Harlan of Philadelphia, former packet rat, imposter, coiner, spy, traitor, revolutionary, and expert in every rascality he can think of. And can't he think just? No common blackguard, mind you. Prince of Gore once, weren't you, Josiah? An unfrocked governor of Gujarat, to say nothing of being a pretender, it's the truth, Flashman, to the throne of Afghanistan, no less. You know what they call this beauty up in the high hills? The man who would be king.
He came forward, thumbs in his belt, and stuck his jaw in Jass's face.
Well, you have 1 minute to tell me what you would be in Lahore, Doctor. And don't say you're an orderly, pure and simple, because you've never been either.
Jasser didn't move a muscle of his ugly, pockmarked face, but turned to me with a little inclination of his head. Leaving aside the insults, part of what he says is true. I was Prince of Gore. But Colonel Gardner's memory is at fault. He hasn't told you that Lord Amherst personally appointed me surgeon to His Britannic Majesty's forces in the Burmese campaign. Assistant surgeon stealing spirits in an artillery field hospital. Scoffs Gardner. Or that I held high military command and the governorship of 3 districts under His late Majesty Raja Ranjit Singh, who kicked you out for counterfeiting, you damn scamp. Go ahead, tell him how you were ambassador to Dost Muhammad and tried to start a revolution in Afghanistan and sold him out more times than he could count. Tell him how you suborned Muhammad Khan to betray Peshawar to the Sikhs. Tell him how you lined your pockets on the Kunduz expedition and cheated Refi Bey, and had the gall to plant the stars and stripes on the Indian Caucasus. Damn your impudence. He paused for breath while Jasser stood cool as a trout.
But why waste time? Tell him how you passed yourself off on Broadfoot. I'd enjoy hearing that myself.
Jasser gave him an inquiring look as though to make sure he was done, and addressed me. "Mr. Flashman, I owe you an explanation, but not an apology. Why should I have told you what your own chief didn't? Broadfoot enlisted me more than a year ago. How much of my history he knows, I can't say. And I don't care. He knows his business, and he trusts me, or I wouldn't be here. If you doubt me now, write to him, telling him what you've heard tonight. Like everyone who's mixed in diplomacy in these parts, I'm used to having my reputation blown upon.
So hard that it's scattered all over the bloody Himalayas,
snarls Gardner.
If you're so all-fired trustworthy, where were you tonight when Jawahir tried to kill Flashman?
He was clever, Gardner. Knowing his man as he did, the question must have been in his mind from the first. But he'd held it back to take Jasser off guard. He succeeded. Jasser gaped, stared from Gardner to me and back, and gasped hoarsely, "What the hell do you mean?" Gardner told him in a few fierce sentences, watching him lynx-eyed. And Jasser was a sight to see. The bounce had quite gone out of him, and all he could do was rub his face and mutter, "Jesus," before turning helplessly to me.
I don't know. I must have been asleep, sir.
After I pulled you onto the balcony and you went off to the Durbar room, well, I reckoned you were there for the night.
He avoided my eye.
I went to bed, woke up an hour ago, saw you hadn't returned, asked around for you, but no one had seen you. Then the Jemadar came for me just now. That's the truth.
He rubbed his face again and caught Gardner's eye.
"Christ, you don't think—"
"No, I don't,"
growled Gardner and shook his head at me.
"Whatever else you are, and that's plenty, you're not a murderer. And if you were, you'd be in the tall timber this minute." "No, Josiah," says he with grim satisfaction, "you're just a lousy bodyguard. And I suggest Mr. Flashman reports that to Major Broadfoot, too. And, until he gets a reply, you can cool your heels in a cell, Doctor."
"The hell I can," cries Jasser and turns to me. "Mr. Flashman, I don't know what to say, sir. I failed you, I know that, and I'm sorry for it. If Major Broadfoot sees fit to recall me, well,
so be it. But it's not his business, sir.
He pointed at Gardner. As far as he's concerned, I'm under British protection and entitled to immunity.
And with respect, sir, in spite of my failure tonight, I'm still at your service. You mustn't disown me, sir.
Well, I'd had a long day and night. The shock of discovering that my Afghan orderly was an American medical man, and no doubt as big a villain as Gardner said, was quite small beer after all the rest. No more of a shock than Gardner himself, really. One thing was sure, Jasser, or Josiah, was Broadfoot's man, and he was right. I couldn't disown him on Gardner's suspicions. I said so, and much to my surprise, Gardner didn't shout me down, although he gave me a long, hard stare.
After what I've told you about him, well, sir, it's on your own head. It's possible you won't rue the day, but I doubt it.
He turned to Jasser.
As for you, Josiah, I don't know what brings you back to the Punjab and another of your disguises. I know it wasn't Jawahir or anything as simple as British political work. No, it's some dirty little frolic of your own, isn't it? Well, you forget it, Doctor, because if you don't, immunity or not, I'll send you back to Broadfoot by tying you over a gun and blowing you clear to Simla. You can count on that. Good night, Mr. Flashman.
The Jemadar led us back to my quarters through a maze of corridors that was no more confused than my mind. I was dog-tired and still mortally shaken, and had neither the wit nor the will to question my newly revealed Afghan-American orderly, who kept up a muttered stream of apology and justification the whole way. He'd never have forgiven himself if any harm had come to me, and I must write to Broadfoot instanter to establish his bona fides. He wouldn't rest until Gardner's calumnies had been disproved. Alec means no harm. We've known each other for years, but truth is, you see, he's jealous, us both being American and all, and he hasn't risen any too high while I've been Prince and Ambassador, as he said. Of course, fate hasn't been too kind lately, which is why I took any honorable employment that came. God, I've no words of excuse or apology, sir, for my lapse tonight. What must you think? What will Broadfoot think? Say, though, I'd like him to understand about my losing my governorship. It wasn't coining, no, sir. I dabble in chemistry, see, and there was this experiment that went wrong.
He was still chuntering when we reached my door, where I was reassured to see two stalwart constables, presumably sent by Bahiram Singh.
Jasser, with that ugly frontier dial and dress, I could think of him by no other name, swore he'd be on hand, too, from this moment, closer than a brother. Why, he'd bed down right here in the passage. I closed my door, head swimming with fatigue, and rested a moment in blessed solitude and quiet before walking unsteadily through the arch to the bedchamber, where two lights burned dimly either side of the pillow, and stopped, the hairs rising on my neck. There was someone in the bed, and a drift of perfume on the air, and before I could move or cry out, a woman whispered out of the gloom.
"My Jane, then, must have eaten her fill," says Mangler. "It is almost dawn."
I stepped closer, staring. She was lying naked beneath a flimsy veil of black gauze spread over her like a sheet. They have nothing to learn about erotic display in the Punjab, I can tell you. I looked down at her, swaying, and it shows how fagged out I was, for I asked, like a damn fool, "What are you doing here?"
"Do you not remember?"
murmurs she, and I saw her teeth gleam as she smiled up from the pillow, her black hair spread across it like a fan.
"After the mistress has supped, it is the maid's turn."
"Oh, my God," says I, "I ain't hungry."
"Are you not?"
whispers she.
"Then I must whet your appetite."
And she sat up slow and languid, stretching that transparent veil tight against her body, pouting at me.
"Will you taste, Huzor?"
For a moment I was tempted, altogether used up, fit only for the knacker's yard. I wanted sleep as I wanted salvation. But as I contemplated that magnificent substance stirring beneath the gauze, I thought, "To thine own self be true," and put temptation aside. "All right you are, my dear," says I. "Got any more of that jolly drink, have you?" She laughed softly and reached out for the cup beside the bed. If you've read Robinson Crusoe, you may recall a passage where he weighs up his plight on the desert island like a bookkeeper, evil on one side, good on t'other. Dispiriting stuff mainly, in which he croaks about solitude, but concludes that things might be worse and God will see him through with luck. Optimism run mad, if you ask me, but then I've never been shipwrecked much, and philosophy in the face of tribulation ain't my line. But I did use his system on waking that second day in Lahore, because so much had happened in such short space that I needed to set my mind straight. Thus, evil. I am cut off in a savage land, which will be at war with my own country presently. Good. I enjoy diplomatic immunity for what it's worth, and am in good health, but ruined. Evil. An attempt has been made to assassinate me. These buggers would sooner murder people than eat their dinners. Good. It failed, and I am under the protection of the Queen Bee, who rides like a rabbit. Also, Gardner will look out for me. Evil. My orderly turns out to be the greatest villain since Dick Turpin, and is an American to boot. Good. Broadfoot chose him, and since I see no reason why he should be hostile to me, I shall watch him like a hawk. Evil. Damn Broadfoot for landing me in this stew when I could have been safe at home, Roger in Elspeth. Good. Rations and quarters are A1, and Mangler sober is a capital mount, though she don't compare to Jandon drunk. Evil. If I were a praying man, the Almighty would hear from me in no uncertain terms, and much good it would do me. Good. Being a pagan, attached Church of England, with no divine resources, I shall tread uncommon wary, and keep my pepper-box handy. That was my accounting, cast up in the drowsy hour after Mangler slipped away like a lovely ghost at daybreak. And it could have been worse. My first task must be to make a searching examination of the bold Jasser, or Josiah, before sending off a cipher about him to Broadfoot. So I had him in while I shaved, watching that crafty hill figurehead in my mirror and listening to the plausible Yankee patter that came out of it. Oddly enough, after the character Gardner had given him, I felt inclined to take him at face value. You see, I'm a knave myself, and know that we wrong'uns ain't always bent on mischief. It seemed to me that Jasser, the professional soldier of fortune, was quite likely just marking time in Broadfoot's employ, as he'd claimed, until something better turned up. The queerest fish swim into the political mill, with not too many questions asked, and I felt I could accept, if not trust him. Like Gardner, I was sure he'd had no hand in the plot against my life. If he'd wanted me dead, he could have let me drop from the balcony instead of saving me. It was comforting, too, to have one of my own kind alongside me, and one who knew the Punjab and its politics inside out. "Though how you hope to pass unrecognized, I don't see," says I. "If you were so high under Runjeet, half the country must know you, surely." "That was 6 years ago, behind a full set of beard and whiskers," says he. "Clean-shaven, I reckon, to get by, except with Alec, but I plan to keep out of his way. But it don't matter.
he added coolly. "There are no reward notices out for Joe Harlan, here or anywhere else." He was such a patent rascal that I took to him, and even now I won't say I was wrong. He had a fine political nose, too, and had been using it about the fort that morning. "Jawa here seems to be in luck. The whole palace knows he tried to get you, and the talk was that the Maharani would have him arrested. But she had him to her boudoir first thing today, all smiles, embraced him, and drank toasts to his reconciliation to the Khalsa, her maid say. It seems Dinanath and Azizuddin have made his peace for him. They were out talking to the Panches at dawn, and Jawahir's appearance this afternoon will be a formality. He and the whole royal family will review the troops, and you'll be invited, no doubt so that you can pass word to Broadfoot that all's well with the Lahore Durbar." He grinned. "Yes, sir, you'll have quite a packet of news for Simla. How do you send out your ciphers, through Mangla?"
"As you said yourself, Doctor, why should I tell you what Broadfoot didn't?"
"Are you really a doctor, by the way?"
"No diploma," says he frankly. "But I studied surgery back in Pennsylvania."
"Yeah, I'll bet it's Mangler. That little puss is in everyone's pocket, so why not John Company's? A word of advice, though. Cover her all you've a mind to, but don't trust her. Or my Jandon."
And before I could damn his impudence, he took himself off to change, as he put it, into his mess kit. That meant his best robes for our Durbar appearance at noon.